The following episode will contain the names of people and places set in the fictional world of the Hyborian Age. With that in mind, be aware that Stephen has an uncanny knack for pronouncing many of these names incorrectly. Listener discretion is advised.
You know who you are?
Stephen is my name.
Even Stephen.
Will you say something, Stephen?
Stephen or else media.
Today on Hither Came Conan, the titular barbarian's dreams are haunted by Lilitu the werewoman. And so the big barbarian gets off his buns of steel and he hunts her down. Will Lilitu and her savage mate survive an encounter with Conan of Cimmeria? The answer may surprise you. Or not. I mean, the brain's a complicated thing. And welcome to Hither Came Conan, the podcast that's treading the jewel thrones of Hyboria beneath its sneakered feet, one comic book at a time. I'm your host, my name is Steven, and I found a nickel on the sidewalk yesterday. Anyway, today we travel once more back to Agrippur as we crawl deep inside Conan the Barbarian number 38 from Marvel Comics. This issue sports a cover date of May 1974, though it hit the stands in February. It sold for just 25 cents, and it is entitled The Warrior and the Werewoman. It was written by Roy Thomas with art by John Buscema. The letters were by John Costanza, and the colorist was Glynis Ween.
Into the boat!
As the issue opens, we are back in Agrippur, and Conan is at a party. It seems that the Cimmerian has been promoted to the rank of captain, a reward for the rescue of Princess Yolanda in the previous issue. And the swinging soiree is to celebrate the big barbarian. But Conan just can't seem to enjoy the party in his honor, because his dreams and nights have been haunted by a demonic woman. And since he can hardly endure the arrogance of Turanian nobles, he turns the revelers against him with his barbarian manners. The fop, Fayed Ratha, lets Conan know that he is aware of the barbarian's dalliances with Commander Narambe's paramour, Amatus. But Conan is in no mood to be blackmailed. During the party, a xenophobic dancing girl attacks Conan with a knife, which he easily diverts. But then she stabs herself to death with it. Strange voices and shadows stalk Conan on the way home, and he nearly attacks Amatus, who had made her way into his quarters. She reveals that Lilitu, a werewoman, has marked Conan as her own and is behind the supernatural attacks. The only one who could lift the curse is the high priest Gimel Ishbi, who was exiled by King Yildiz because of all his bloodthirstiness in his rituals. And now the old sorcerer dwells in the Mound of the Moon west of the city. Amatus returns to her quarters, where she reveals to an unknown master the conversation she'd had with Conan. Meanwhile, the Cimmerian finds Gimel Ishbi, who provides to Conan a magical item he can use to break the werewoman's curse. All Gimel Ishbi asks in return is a human life, and so Conan pays the priest in full with a quick death.
Oh, he's died!
His debt paid, Conan stalks away to some nearby ruins to lay his trap. Soon he is attacked by and captures some sort of man-bat. This is Ardet Lily, the mate of Lilitu. In return for sparing her mate's life, Conan makes Lilitu tell him who wanted the curse placed on him. When he hears the name, Conan grimly lets the man-bat-wolfman-creature thing go. The barbarian, however, realizes too late that he neglected to have Lilitu promise not to kill him before releasing her mate. And soon, the two attack. Conan flees, making it outside the ruins, when he runs into the source of his troubles, Narambe, who has known for some time of his lover's betrayal. With relative ease, Conan is able to pull Narambe from his horse, taking it for himself as he leaves the commander to deal with Lilitu and her mate himself. And so as the issue ends, fed up with Turanian civilization, betrayed by Amatus, and fearing the return of his foe Prince Yezdegerd to the capital, Conan decides he's had enough of Turin, and he rides west towards the Hyborian kingdoms once again. All right, so this story was based on the Robert E. Howard tale, The House of Erebu, which was not originally a Conan story, but instead featured Pyrrhus, a Greek barbarian who is cursed and then sets out to find out who did it and to get his revenge upon them. It was rejected by Weird Tales on January 19th, 1933, and was not published until 1952 under the title Witch from Hell's Kitchen. And that was in Avon Fantasy Reader number 18. This issue had been in the works for a few months as Roy had to introduce into the Conan comics the three characters from the House of Erebu, as they would play, you know, they'd play a part, small or big, you decide, in the path that Conan chooses for himself here at the end of the issue. From the House of Erebu, the character of Prince Anakili became the foppish Fayed Rotha. There was also Naram Ninib, who would become Naram Bey. And then, of course, Amytis, who, well, Roy decided to keep her name intact. Roy had introduced Naram Bey and Amytis all the way back in issue number 32, Flame Winds of Lost Kitai, a full 6 months before this issue, The Warrior and the Werewoman, showing, I guess, how far in advance some of the planning was in regard to Conan's story folding out in front of them. Fayed Rotha, by the way, was first introduced in issue number 36, Beware the Hyrcanians Bearing Gifts, in case you wanted to, I don't know, make note of that or something. With that said, grab up your copies of Conan the Barbarian number 38, because we are about to dive. We will start, as always, with the cover. This cover was penciled by Gil Kane and inked by Ernie Chan, and it features Conan, of course, battling Lilitu, who is perched on some type of pillar from the ruined city. She's perched there behind him as he battles Ardat Lili, or Ardat Lili, or Ardat Lili. I don't know. You decide. Tell me, how do you think you pronounce that dude's name? And this is a character, the mate of Lilitu. He looks somewhat like a werewolf if you're looking at the cover and the rest of the issue when he is in this human-like guise or his bipedal form, because he takes a second form the first time we see him in the issue. But he looks sort of like a werewolf, but I referred to him in the synopsis as a man-bat, and we'll talk about why that is later. But I really like this cover. I'm a big fan of this cover. It looks like a lot of fun. It looks like something, if I had seen it there on the shelf, I would be just ready and raring and itching, and maybe not itching. That's not something you want to do in a public place, or at least scratching the itch. I don't know where I'm going with that. Anyway, yeah, had I seen this, had I been around at the time, which 74, I would have been 2, but I would have picked it up. Not at 2. If I was maybe 10 years old at this point, yeah, I would have looked at that, 12, 14. Maybe even 18 years old, I would have said, yeah, that looks like something fun. Because Conan's got a sword in one hand. It's got blood dripping off of it from where he has struck out at this werewolf-looking dude, Ardat Lili. And in his other hand, he's got a dagger, and he looks pretty kick-ass. He's wearing his skirt, and his legs are spread wide open, but the artist and inker have covered his groin in black, so we don't see what's under the skirt. But I'm pretty sure we've seen in previous issues that he has a little pair of trunks on under there. His man thing isn't just dangling, his twig and berries, they're not just dangling for everybody to see. That would be, I don't know, I'd be worried in a sword fight if my thing was just dangling there for any blade to catch it. I'd rather have it tucked up under a pair of trunks of some sort. Anyway, we open the book, we get to page one, the splash page. It gives us a bit of the Nemedian Chronicles. Know, O Prince, that between the years when the oceans drank Atlantis and the years of the rise of the sons of Arius, there was an age undreamed of when shining cities lay spread across the world like blue mantles beneath the stars. Hither came Conan the Barbarian,
black-haired, sullen-eyed, a thief, a reaver, a slayer.
That's been condensed a bit, of course. It feels more, it fits more like the bit that they narrate at the beginning of both Conan the Barbarian and Conan the Destroyer, the movies from the 80s. But from there, we get the title of the issue, The Warrior and the Werewoman. And I guess before we should go any further, we should talk about the name of Lalitu, or the fact that Lalitu is referred to as a werewoman. Because in his book, Barbarian Life, a literary biography of Conan the Barbarian, Volume 1, Roy Thomas does address the use of the word were in Werewoman, saying,
"And before anybody gets upset, I know as well as anyone that since the were in werewolf means man, the term werewoman actually means man-woman, not wolf-woman. But there's a long tradition in horror fiction to use werewoman for a female werewolf, and I saw no reason to break with it."
They do actually, at one point, I'll try to remember to point it out, they do actually refer to her mate as a were-man, which, in this case, based on what Roy is telling us, would be a man-man. So, yeah, doesn't make a lot of sense. Anyway, back to the splash page. We are at a party. It's actually the feast hall of Narambe, the commander of the cavalry garrison at Agrippur. And Conan is sitting there next to Narambe. He's nursing a flagon of mead or a cup of wine. Who knows what he's drinking? But Narambe is sitting on some pillows. Conan is on one side of him, sitting on a pillow. And on the other side of Narambe is Amatis, who also, she looks like she has an empty glass of wine in her hand. And I don't want to say glass because they don't look like they're made of glass, but that's kind of the nomenclature of today. Or not. I don't know. Talking out of my ass here. Anyway, it looks like they are sitting in a conversation pit. If you've ever seen a house from the 60s or 70s in the living room, there's a bit. Sometimes they have a bit in the middle of the living room where the floor sinks down a number of inches and you can sit in this pit. There are couches and whatnot. And I've always wanted one. If I ever came into a number of millions of dollars and I built my own house, I would have a conversation pit. But this isn't exactly a conversation pit. It's more like a stage, but instead of being raised up above the floor, it's sunken into the floor, maybe a foot. And on this stage, this sunken stage, is a dancing woman. We get the note here that this is freely adapted from the story The House of Erebu by Robert E. Howard, creator of Conan. And we are given, of course, the credits. Roy Thomas, author and editor, and John Buscema, artist. I want to point out that Buscema did his own inks on this one. Apparently, there was time for him to do that because they've been working on this issue far enough in advance that when Neil Adams came in to pencil the previous issue, it provided John Buscema enough time to both pencil and ink, which, from what I understand, if he had the time to do so, he would always prefer to ink his own stuff. And if it wasn't inked by him, I guess he preferred to have his brother Sal ink him. But from what I've gathered so far, typically his inker on this series has been Ernie Chan and will be Ernie Chan for a number of issues. I always liked John Buscema's run on The Avengers in the 80s that was inked by Tom Palmer. That's kind of my favorite John Buscema artwork, is that Avengers run. Anyway, Conan's sitting here nursing his wine. He doesn't look happy. Narambe is asking him, you know, what's up? You know, you've just been promoted to captain. Why are you so sullen? Or as he puts it, even more sullen than usual. And he asks if it's a woman. Does he have a woman on his mind? Is a woman making him sad and depressed? And Conan says, yes, it is a woman. And she haunts his dreams, but she's not a woman. A woman, and yet not a woman. We also see on this page the other people partying around them. There's a half-naked woman in the foreground, just right there at the bottom of the page, hanging out with some dude with the big old mustache. And then there are people in the background that look like they're about to, you know, get it on. We turn the page. This is where we learn that Conan was promoted to the rank of captain because he rescued Yolanda in the previous issue. And Amytus asks if Yolanda is the woman that's on his mind. But Conan explains to them, no, it's a woman that he is seeing. Well, here, this is what Conan says. Sometimes it's easier just to read their dialogue.
I only speak what I see in my dreams. There in the midnight of my mind, I feel her sharp teeth in my neck. And I wake to hear the flutter of bat wings, the howl of an unseen wolf. Perhaps Juma was wise to ask a tour of duty rather than a promotion.
And of course, here's where we learn why Juma is not in this one. He too helped rescue Princess Yolanda, but instead of asking for a promotion as his reward, he asks for a tour of duty, which gets him away from Agrippur. And Conan's thinking that was probably the sweeter deal. That's when this dude just comes rolling up on Conan. He just comes stepping up to him. He's crouched over him, standing above him, bent over, slightly crouched. He's got one foot down in the sunken stage, one foot on the area of the floor where Conan is sitting. He's I don't know why I said crouched. He's kind of bent at his waist. He's got his arm resting on his knee, and he's holding a cup of wine, which is spilling out all over the floor. And he just starts getting all in Conan's face, telling him that he heard that Conan killed a number of priests on his last mission to Kitai. And apparently that upsets him for some reason or another. And Conan, you know, being Conan, Conan's not going to take any shit from anybody. He doesn't get up, though, because that's not the way Conan rolls. He doesn't just immediately spring to his feet and start beating the guy down. He just simply asks from his seated position who the dude is. Actually, he doesn't even ask. He just says,
I don't know you, fellow.
And the guy tells him that his name is Ebi Enger, and he's Nerimbe's cousin. And so Conan, still seated, reaches out, grabs the guy from his shirt collar, basically, the front of his shirt, pulls him around in front of Conan, forces him to his knees. So now Conan, still sitting, has got this dude forcibly down on his knees in front of him. And Conan's telling him that, not that it's any of his business, but it was actually the priest's former subjects that slew them, and that the priests were wizards. They were the wizards of Wan Tangri. But most importantly, Conan wants to know how this asshole got that information, because it's supposed to be a secret, and that was ordered by Nerimbe himself. And so Conan wonders aloud to this guy that, you know, is that something that happens in these so-called civilized lands, that, you know, that people spy on their friends as well as their enemies? The guy, however, he's obviously frightened, but he considers himself to be a better person than Conan, because Conan's a barbarian. Obviously, this guy, the cousin to the commander of not all the forces in Agrippur, but I don't know, Nerimbe's a pretty high-ranking dude, and this guy's his cousin, so he just assumes that he's better than anybody below Nerimbe. And so he pulls a dagger, and he is going to kill Conan just for laying his hands on Ebi Enger, because Conan is below him, and you don't lay your hands on one of your betters. Conan, of course, picks the guy back up and throws him across this stage, this sunken-in stage. I don't know what you would call it. If anybody knows what a sunken-in stage is called, let me know. But it's a large room. You got to have some strength to just pick up a dude one-handed, because that's what Conan does. Picks him up one-handed and flings him across the room. And it's not until as he's actually throwing the guy that he starts to rise. So basically, he does all this still sitting. But in order to actually heave him across the room, Conan has to stand a bit. And then he apologizes to Nerimbe for tossing his cousin across the room. Nerimbe doesn't seem to care. He says that Ebi Enger was ever a fool, and that when his head clears, when he's not drunk anymore, when he sobers up, he's going to realize how lucky he is that Conan didn't just lop his head off right then and there. It's at that point that Fayed Ratha comes rolling up to Conan, and he tells Conan that, hey, buddy, I know that you've been sleeping with Amytus, who is Nerimbe's paramour, or his lover. And he might, Fayed Ratha, he might be convinced not to tell Narambe if, you know, Conan was to provide him with a little something-something.
Hither Came Conan will return after these messages.
Hey there, comic fans and children of the 80s. My name is Steven, and I would like to invite you to join me on another G.I. Joe podcast. If you grew up yelling, "Yo, Joe," or flipping through dog-eared issues of G.I. Joe, A Real American Hero, this is the show for you. Each episode, we're tackling one issue of the classic Marvel comic series, starting all the way back in 1982. We'll break down the stories, the artwork, the characters, the wild twists, the covert missions, everything that made this series one of the most surprisingly rich comic runs of the decade. We'll follow the rise of Snake Eyes, the schemes of Cobra Commander, the battles, the vehicles, the ninjas, the chaos, and the totally over-the-top, totally awesome storytelling that defined 80s action. Whether you're reliving your childhood or discovering these comics for the first time, I'm here to guide you through it all with excitement, insight, and plenty of nostalgia. So grab your gear and join the team, because the mission begins now. Yo, Joe!
The Outcasters starts a bold new direction by covering Avengers Under Siege with Earth's mightiest podcasters. Outcasters Under Siege, coming in 2026, only on the Right On Network.
And now back to Hither Came Conan.
Conan kind of interrupts him as he's talking and says that basically threatens his life by saying that what he could provide Fayed Ratha is that he'd let him live. And that should be reason enough to keep his mouth shut. Conan doesn't know Fayed Ratha that well. That was probably a mistake. But Fayed Ratha leaves. He's like, "All right, I hear you. I hear what you're saying. I'll go talk to some other people." And then he has somebody bring, you know, a woman bring some more wine for Conan. The next page, the party goes on. And later in the evening, as Conan still just lounges, drinking wine, being all sullen, melancholy, as the Nemedian Chronicles say, he's capable of both gigantic mirth and gigantic melancholies. Well, this is one of his gigantic melancholies. And he's kind of bummed because he doesn't really want to be an Agrippur anymore. If you remember, he got in a big fight with Prince Yezdegerd. He is the son of the king of Turin. Yezdegerd is out conquering other lands for the crown. But when he and Conan fought, because Conan used to serve as a soldier under Prince Yezdegerd, they fought. Conan slashed at his face with a sword and scarred him. And Yezdegerd has vowed to see Conan's head on a spike. Conan escaped. He ended up back in Agrippur and working for the very same army, but Yezdegerd's off fighting other battles. So Conan's just kind of hanging out, but he doesn't really want to be there anymore. He is worried that at any point Yezdegerd might show back up, and not that he's afraid of Yezdegerd, but he knows that that's going to complicate things, and he'd just rather kind of chill at this point. But the only thing that's actually keeping him in Agrippur is Amytus. Again, Narambe is Conan's boss, basically, and Amytus is his lover, his mistress, but she has eyes for Conan. Conan and her have been sneaking around behind Narambe's back and getting it on. Well, I mean, basically, Conan wants that to continue. He's there for her, and that's the only reason he's sticking around. And as he's contemplating that, and as Amytus lounges with Narambe, running her fingers through his hair, she's also looking over at Conan with eyes that say,
"You big, brawny, butch barbarian. If Narambe wasn't here right now, I'd crawl over to you on my hands and knees, and, well, let's just say that the two of us would once more become lovers in the nighttime.
It's then that this woman who had been dancing for all there to see, she's the entertainment, she suddenly draws a dagger and runs at Conan, telling him, well, this is what she screams out.
Death to all foreign devils in the lap of Turin! Death to barbarians who sprawl at ease among the sons of Tarim! And so, man of the West, death to you!
She leaps on him. They tussle for a bit. Conan easily deflects the dagger, but then she turns it on herself, plunges it into her chest, and she dies. I do want to point out there are two panels on this page, page 4 of the story. When we see the dancing woman pull the dagger, she's taking it from one of the partygoers who has passed out. But for some reason, this is one of those instances where we're still in that era of comic books where the writer or writers, anybody who's writing comic books at the time, some of them don't quite trust the readers to understand what's going on. Because if you just look at the three panels in the middle of this page, we can see this dancing woman pulling a dagger. She's crouched over the inert body of a man who is obviously passed out drunk. In the second panel, she's running across the room with the dagger in her hand, and that's when she starts screaming death to all foreign devils in the lap of Turin. Well, you don't really need much to understand what's going on. You don't need any narration. You don't need anything to tell the reader. It's obvious she's pulling a dagger, and based on what she's screaming, she's there to kill Conan. Her eyes, when she pulls the dagger, are very big and bulging. She looks mad. She looks a little insane. The fact that the attack ends with her killing herself kind of tells you what her mental state is. But Roy apparently felt that the reader needed a little help. And so he has this dialogue from people off screen, off camera, off panel. So this is what we're hearing in the first panel as she's drawing the dagger from the passed out drunk guy.
Look, look at the dancer, Belibna, at the wild light in her eyes. Why, she is drawing that drunken sot's dagger.
And then in the second panel, as she's running across the room, just before she screams, death to all foreign devils, we hear, again, one of these two people, maybe a third person.
Verily, the hand of the dark god Erlik is upon her.
This just drives me insane. I don't know why Roy put this in here. I think it's stupid. It really took me out of the issue there for a second. I don't understand. I mean, I understand why he did it. I would assume, anyways, that he just doesn't trust the reader to understand what's going on here in these three panels, that he needs to point out that maybe her faculties aren't with her. But I don't know. I just don't like it. We didn't need it. We didn't need all that to figure out what was going on. And adding that in makes it hokey and corny. That's just my opinion. It just seems dumb. So we turn the page, page 5 of the story. The woman is dead. Conan is holding her. He's kneeling there on the floor. He's holding her dead body in his arms, and he hears a voice. But to understand what the voice is telling him, you need to know what he is saying first.
Mitra! She drove the dagger deep into her own heart as she fell. Here was strong madness indeed. Madness, Outlander, or a dead priest's curse?
Conan looks around to see where the voice came from. It didn't come from anybody. According to the narration, the words seemed to come from no guest and from all of the guests at the same time. Well, that's when Conan's decided he's had enough of all this shit. He gets up and he leaves the party. Naram Bey leaves with him. So the two of them are walking down the dark streets of Agrippur. Conan is asking Naram Bey if, you know, the commander is worried about his reputation being seen hanging out with old Conan. Naram Bey is telling him, you don't got to worry about that. But that's when Conan sees a freaking cobra on the ground. And he steps between Naram Bey and the cobra, telling Naram Bey that, you know, it is a cobra. It's something that he's only seen in Kitai, a snake that is more deadly than any other snake he's ever come across before, and he is about to chop it up with his sword when he realizes that it's gone. Naram Bey tells him it was never there in the first place and suggests that maybe Conan retires to his new quarters. But the way he says it almost as if he's trying to hypnotize Conan. Or maybe he's already inside his mind, maybe, because the way he suggests that Conan retire to his new quarters, what he says is this.
Why don't you retire to your new quarters? You are tired.
And Conan, who's kind of bent over, wiping sweat from his brow, he says,
yes, tired. Tired or else accursed.
And he sets off to his new quarters. Now, I didn't pick up on this before. It's not until later when I learned, of course, when we all learned as we're reading this issue, that Naram Bey is the bad guy, that he's found out about Conan and Amytus, and he has sent Lilitu and her mate to kill Conan, and they are, or at least Lilitu is just fucking with Conan in his dreams and in his mind. Or maybe it's Naram Bey that's doing that, right? That's the kind of, that's what I kind of pick up here with this one single panel, the way he says, you are tired, because it's not a question. They don't put a question mark after it. It's more like he is implanting that suggestion into Conan's brain so that Conan then will feel tired and go home, which is exactly what he does. Back in his quarters, he strips off all of his clothes except for his boots, his skirt, and he leaves his belt with his sword still strapped to it, leaves that on as well, and he falls into bed, falls asleep, and he dreams again of some demon woman. And it's during these dreams that, you know, he's haunted by this shadow of a woman. She seems to be up to no good. She's beckoning him. He kind of wakes up in the middle of this dream, and he still sees her there and can sense her there. But then suddenly, she's gone. He knows she was there. He can hear like a mocking laugh in the distance around him, kind of, right? But he knows that she was there. But then suddenly he senses that there is actually somebody in the room with him. We turn to page 7. He has drawn his sword, whips around, grabs up who's ever there in the room with him, and it turns out to be Amytus. She has snuck away from her man, Naram Bey. He is sleeping, and she's come to Conan to, it's a booty call. It's a Hyborian Age booty call. But Conan, frankly, he's not having any of it. He's just not in the mood. He describes to Amytus kind of what was in his dream, and she tells him without any hesitation that it was Lilitu, the werewoman, and that she has marked Conan for her own. He is accursed, and it was not done by the Khitans. That's what kind of Conan has been thinking, that ever since he was in Khitai and he, you know, was in Wan Tengri and he fought those wizards, that maybe one of them before they died had cursed him. But she explains to him that that's not the case. It's Lilitu, the night spirit who dwells in the caverns of Erlik, who is some kind of dark god. Anyway, Conan's curious why suddenly she tells him this now. You know, he mentioned it earlier during the party. She didn't say anything about it then, but she explains that she sensed it all along. She's known about it because, as she puts it,
a woman knows the spells of other women.
Which I guess just basically means that what she's trying to tell him is she knew that he was cursed by Lilitu, the werewoman, because she's a woman and she can sense it. That's just what women do. And she's come to him tonight, or at least as she's telling him this. I mean, she came to see him because she wanted to get a bit of him rubbing up against a bit of her. You know what I'm saying? Sorry, I don't mean to automatically turn into a fifth grader, but that's what us guys do sometimes. Anyway, as they're talking this through, as she explains what she knows, she tells him that if he swears never to leave her, that she can help him. And Conan, he has kind of been pushed over the edge. He's not willing at this point to negotiate, and he does something that I'm not all that happy about, but he grabs her by the hair from the back of her head and pulls her backwards in a, you know, very violent fashion that has got to hurt. And he's basically telling her to explain everything to him, give him the information he needs, or basically he's going to pull all the hair off of her head. And so she tells him that he needs to go see a guy named Gimel Ishbi. He is a priest who once served the living Tareem himself. We turn to page 8, and she goes into a bit more detail, I guess. Gimel Ishbi, priest of the living Tareem, he went a little too far, like most sorcerers, and he dabbled in the dark arts. She says that he trafficked with demons, darker even than unholy Erlik, and he executed a whole bunch of people, a bunch of people who were worshippers of the living Tareem. And finally, King Yildiz could stand it no longer, and he banished Gimel Ishbi from Agrippur. Conan asks where he is found. She then explains that Gimel Ishbi lives alone in the Mound of the Moon west of the city. Conan tells her, oh, I know that place, later, and then leaves. It's a wonderful scene. I love this scene because as she's talking to him about Gimel Ishbi, you know, once she reveals where he lives, Conan just up and leaves. And he's standing behind her. He tells her that he knows the place. He says farewell. And she says,
no, do not go, my lover. Stay with me just a little while.
And the narration tells us that her only answer is the staccato hum of hoofbeats dwindling swiftly away into the west. So he probably didn't even hear her beg him to stay. He said farewell, and he was out of that room like a shot, because as she finishes begging, he's already riding down the street. I just think that's funny.
Hither Came Conan will return after these messages.
Hi, I'm Eric, host of the Long Box Review podcast. I love comic books so much that I started Long Box Review to celebrate my love for them and connect with others who share my passion. Each month, I critique the comics I've read and present other topics, such as spotlights on specific issues, My Comics History, The Legion Project with Peter Rios, where we discuss the Legion of Superheroes, and so much more. Additionally, the Long Box Review podcast feed includes The Gutters, my audio journal, and Center Seat, my Star Trek podcast. The Long Box Review website also examines comic books outside of the podcast, such as the series 52, Justice, and others. Please join me as I celebrate nearly 50 years of comic book reading and over 15 years of podcasting. You can visit longboxreview.com for more information. And thanks for listening.
Do you love podcasting but hate editing? Do you have a number of episodes recorded but just can't find the time to get them edited and ready for release? Do you need help and you're not sure what to do? Well, come talk to me. My name is Stephen Orr. I have over a decade of experience recording and editing my own podcasts, and I want to put those skills to work for you. I can remove that background noise. I can reduce silences. I'll remove all of your ums and your uhs, as well as your throat clearing, sneezes, and coughs and such. And I can even add your music and whatnot. And hey, my prices are quite reasonable. Check out edityourpod.com to get started. That's edityourpod.com, or just reach out to me directly. Email edityourpod@gmail.com. Tell me what you need, and I'll tell you how I can help. And more importantly, I'll quote you a cost. edityourpod.com. Get started today.
And now back to Hither Came Conan.
So she leaves his room, starts heading back, I guess, to where she dwells, to Naren Bay's place, and she meets somebody in the shadows, a shadowy figure that we can't see. Somebody, it's made clear, who sent her to tell Conan about Lilitu. Apparently, though, she wasn't supposed to tell him about Gimel Ishbi, but she claims that Conan tortured her, which he did. And whoever this mystery person is that she's telling this information to decides, well, I guess if he knows that, I should probably head out, follow him, and make sure that everything is done the way it's supposed to be done. Conan then goes to find Gimel Ishbi. He finds him in this cave. Gimel Ishbi already knows who Conan is, even knows that Conan was just recently promoted to captain. And he tells Conan that it's because, you know, despite the fact that King Yildiz has banished him, he still has like a shit ton of spies within Agrippur, and they tell him everything he needs to know. Well, Conan throws a bunch of gold on the table, saying that he needs some kind of charm because he's going to go fight some devils, and he needs a bit of sorcery to, you know, give him an edge, right? I should add here real quick, I forgot to mention it. You know, I said that when he fell into bed, he basically took off. He was wearing like a shirt and a cape along with his boots and his skirt and his sword. And so when he went to bed, all he did was take off his shirt and his cape. He went to sleep with his boots on, with his skirt thing on, and with his sword still strapped to his belt. And so that's what he's wearing now. He was in such a hurry to get this taken care of, he didn't even throw his shirt on. He just goes out shirtless. But that's what Conan does, right? He's a big hunky shirtless dude. Anyway, he throws gold down on this table in front of Gimel Ishby, tells him that he wants to buy some magic. Gimel Ishby turns the gold into dust and makes it blow away because to him, he explains gold is nothing more than dust, that he will give Conan this magical item and they'll discuss payment later. So what he gives him is this small cask full of dust, and he tells Conan that it's not merely dust, it is a soul. And he then gives Conan basically instructs Conan on how to use this soul dust. They don't go into any detail here. It's just something that happens kind of in between panels. The narration tells us that the wizard whispers into Conan's ear the words of magic and the instructions on what he needs to do. And here on page 11 of the story, after he gives Conan everything he needs, he then tells him of the price, which is a human life. And what he actually tells Conan is,
I have one price for all, a human life. Death is my rapture, be it man, maid, or infant. You have sworn, make good your oath, a life, a human life.
And that's when Conan sticks him with his sword and kills him.
Aye,
says Conan.
A life then.
Now, I should point out that in his book, Barbarian Life, a literary biography of Conan the Barbarian, Volume 1, Roy talks about this scene and the death of Gimel Ishby, comparing it to the moment in House of Erebu, where the barbarian in that story, Pyrrhus, kills... Here's what he says.
There is one change I wish I had made with regard to the death of Gimel Ishby. Pyrrhus kills the conjurer in cold blood, a rather unheroic act, after the old man gives him the information he needs. And I carried this over to Conan. In retrospect, I wish I had made Gimel Ishby even more of an obvious villain, perhaps making clear what is merely hinted at in the comic, namely, that he wants Conan's soul in exchange for his help. Then Gimel would have more clearly deserved Conan's sword.
I honestly, Roy, gotta disagree with you here. I don't know if this is just another instance where, based on the comic book industry at the time, Roy, just like many of the other writers at the time, didn't quite trust the readers to understand what was going on in the story unless they really over-explained everything. In this case, while I didn't necessarily get that the life that Gimel Ishby wanted in payment was Conan, it's very clear that the dude is evil. I mean, he tells Conan basically he needs a human life, be it man, maid, or infant. Right there, that's all you need to know. And I have no issue with Conan cutting him down at that point. And Roy, if you think that people didn't understand that Gimel Ishby was a very bad guy and probably deserved the death he got, then I don't know, dude. You got to trust in your readers a bit more. Anyway, with the death of Gimel Ishby, we turn the page to page 12 of the story. Conan's horse has ridden off. There's something about the death of Gimel Ishby that made the horse scream in terror and ride off. And so Conan takes the soul dust. He strides over to the ruins. He picks a room, goes inside, spreads the dust down over the doorway and in the windows. He retreats to a shadowy corner so that nobody can see him in there. And then he waits. Turn the page. We're now on page 13 of the story. A giant bat. That's what it looks like. They refer to it in the narration as a night fiend. But to me, It's very, it's just one small panel, but it looks like a bat that flies into the room where Conan is. As soon as it's in the room, Conan speaks the words of magic. The bat thing changes into a more human-like figure. It does look a bit like a werewolf, but you can also see the bat influence in its face as well. Anyway, with the speaking of the magic words, the thing crashes to the floor, screaming. Conan walks up to it, realizes it's not Lilitu, and decides, you're not what I came looking for, and so runs it through with his sword. Now, this is a part that I didn't quite like, because granted, yes, it's a monster. Granted, we know in hindsight that it's a evil monster. Conan is literally judging this creature on sight. The thing flies into the room, and it doesn't attack Conan, or at least maybe it was obvious to Conan that it was about to attack him before he said the magic words. I don't know. But other than the fact that it is monstrous looking and that it flew into the room in the form of a giant bat, it's done nothing that I can see to show that it's any threat to Conan. It's not done anything other than just look frightening. And so Conan decides it's been called up from hell, and he runs it through with his sword. Luckily for the creature, it doesn't die. He doesn't even get any blood on the sword. It just lays there and screams, and that's when Lilitu shows up. She walks to the doorway but doesn't come inside. She senses that basically this powder, this soul powder that he puts down, it kind of works like the salt on Supernatural. When he said the magic words, it erected a barrier around the room that has trapped this bat thing, which turns out to be Ardat Lily. It's trapped it inside the room, and it's evidently causing this creature a lot of pain as well, because it won't stop screaming. And the spell also won't allow Lilitu into the room. So she basically tells Conan, look, tell me what you want me to do. I will do it for you. And then you let my mate go. There's actually a couple of moments here at the top of story page 15. But before she offers this, Conan's kind of messing with her. And he's like, look, you got to help me here. Otherwise, I'm just going to keep doing this. And he just repeatedly stabs at Ardat Lily over and over, which again doesn't kill it, but it's obviously in pain. And so that's when Lilitu says, all right, tell me what you want. Tell me what you want me to do, and I will do it for you. Just release my man. And so Conan asks her, who sent you against me? She tells him, we don't learn the name yet, but it's all Conan needs. So he steps outside of the dwelling, says the words of magic once more. Ardat Lily can now leave the room. And that's when Conan realizes that he fucked up. He actually says,
Crom, take me for a blind fool. I forgot to make them swear an oath that would have bound them from my flesh.
In other words, the one thing Conan forgot to do was tell Lilitu, all right, tell me who sent you and promise that you and your mate will leave me alone and then I will let your mate go. He left that second part out, and so now they are chasing him through the ruins. It's a number of pages, this flight, this chase through the ruins. It's actually pretty good. Conan is climbing up walls and leaping from wall to wall and roof to roof and ruin to ruin because he was born climbing, you know, the rocks and the hills and the crags in Sumeria. This is kind of what he does best. But he knows that his pursuers will never tire out. This is only going to delay things. They will get him, they will catch him, and they will kill him. It's at this point, however, as Conan reaches the edge of the ruins, that a man on horseback rides up, and it is Nerimbe. And that's when, as a reader, we discover that Nerimbe is the bad guy in all this. He set Lilitu after Conan, and he has come to make sure that Conan dies. And so he runs at Conan. He's on horseback. Conan's on foot. Nerimbe draws his sword and goes galloping toward Conan, telling him that it took precious few beatings to force his amethyst to spout the details of her faithlessness. Conan, however, he just kind of sidesteps the charge, grabs the horse by the reins, yanks the horse enough that the horse kind of stumbles, but doesn't fall. But it does manage to knock Naram Bey off of the horse. Conan kind of slashes at him as he falls, doesn't kill him. But Conan then climbs into the saddle, steals Naram Bey's horse, rides away, and on page 19 of the story, the final page of the story, actually, Conan leaves Naram Bey to be killed by Lalitu and her mate, which Conan guesses that by killing him, they'll be satisfied. And we actually get, as the issue ends, we get a three panels at the bottom that tell us that Lalitu and her mate should be sated and that the road to Agrippur is open for Conan to return. But he sits there atop his horse and he thinks for a bit, and he realizes that he doesn't want to go back to Agrippur. The one thing that kept him in Agrippur is the love of Amytis. But he's kind of decided at this point that he's had enough of her. And so he wheels his horse around to ride westward back toward the Hyborian kingdoms, which, as the narration says, are more to his liking. And the whole time, he's laughing his butt off. And that's how the issue ends. It was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed this one. This is going to be up there in one of my favorites. I haven't ranked anything just yet, but this one was really good. I really enjoyed the art. John Buscema inking himself is something to behold. And I like that 6 months before this issue came out, Roy knew maybe not what each issue was going to be between issue 32 and this issue here, but he knew that he was getting to this. He knew that at some point, Conan had to leave Turin. He can't stay in Turin. And so he found this story, House of Erebu, and it kind of fit with what he wanted to do to get Conan out of Turin. And so he started planting the seeds early by introducing Naram Bey and Amytis in issue 32. I like that kind of stuff. It's like the other host on the Superman Super Show, Ed, he always says that continuity is his reward for reading a book for hundreds and hundreds of issues, right? When you run into something in an issue that's like, they're calling back to an issue 3 years ago. And that's he feels like that's his reward. And I agree. I like that kind of stuff too. And I like how this was set up. And I like that it ends in such a way, because there has come a point during all these issues in which Conan has been dealing with the Turanians. And it's gone back, like all the way back to when he first hooked up with Prince Yezdegerd. And I don't know what issue that is off the top of my head. I didn't make that note. So Alice is going to come in and let us know what that issue is.
Conan first encountered the Turanians at the end of Conan the Barbarian number 18, The Thing in the Temple, from June of 1972.
But yeah, the Turanians have been such a big part of Conan's storyline for so long that it's nice to get to the end of this issue and know that we're moving away from that. We're getting back into the Hyborian lands. I feel like at this point, it just the anything can happen, right? And it's not that I was feeling bored with the series so far, but it's we get to this issue, we get to this ending, and it's almost like, okay, now we're breathing some new life into the series. I didn't realize that things were getting stale until we got to this point. But now that we got to this point, I realize, all right, it was getting stale. And now let's get Conan back to doing what he does, which is roaming the world and getting into adventures. But that, folks, is all I have to say about Conan the Barbarian number 38, The Warrior and the Werewoman. If you have anything you'd like to add, let me know. The easiest way to do that is by email. The address is feedback@hithercameconan.com. So shoot me a line, and who knows? Maybe I'll read it out in a future episode.
Everybody out!
In our next episode, Conan is waylaid by bandits and bitten by a snake as he travels west. Both events cause a delay in the Cimmerian's journey and also puts him face to face with a dragon. That's next time as we dive into Conan the Barbarian number 39, The Dragon from the Inland Sea, published in March of 1974. The synopsis used in this episode was taken from MarvelFandom.com and was not changed in any way. Well, that is except for the bits that I changed, because, I mean, they were incorrect. They had to be changed. Anyway, the information used in this episode comes from Wikipedia, along with Mike's Amazing World of Comics at Mike'sAmazingWorld.com, and the book, Barbarian Life, a Literary Biography of Conan the Barbarian, Volume 1, by Roy Thomas, which you can get now at SumerianPress.com. And finally, the views and opinions expressed within this episode are mine and mine alone, and do not reflect the official policy or position of Marvel Comics, Roy Thomas, the Howard Estate, Conan, his sword, his steely thews, his many fans and supporters, and especially his god, Krom.
Krom laughs at the four winds.
So until next time, folks, keep your swords close by, never stop treading them jeweled thrones, and as always, be nice to each other. Bye!
We would like to thank you for listening to this episode of Hither Came Conan. Questions and comments can be directed to feedback@hithercameconan.com. If you enjoyed the show, you can help to boost our presence online by leaving a rating or review on your favorite podcast app. We would also like to invite you to join our subscription program, Stephen or Else Beyond. And in return, you'll get episodes of Hither Came Conan early and ad-free. Check out the link in the show notes, or just go to hithercameconan.com to sign up today. Hither Came Conan is a presentation of Stephen or Else Media. For more nerdy content hosted by Stephen, check out somanypodcasts.com. All links will be in the show notes.
Meanwhile, the Sumerian finds Gimel Ishbi. Gimel Ishbi. Gimel. I like that name. Gimel Ishbi. Meanwhile, the Sumerian finds Gimel Ishbi, who provides Conan a magical item he can use to break the werewoman's curse. Break it over her head. His debt paid, Conan stalks away to some nearby ruins to lay his trap. Ruins. 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 All right. Let's do it. Soon he is attacked by and captures some sort of man bat, Ardit Lily, the mate of Lily 2. In return for Ardit Lily's life, Conan makes Lily 2 tell him who you beat me. I'm just killing time here because I'm looking up the name of Ardit Lily in the comic book, because Marvel Fandom has it listed as Ardit Lilu, but I'm fairly certain the comic book lists it as Ardit Lily, which, I don't know, I think is kind of a weird name. But let us see, shall we? Bing, bing, bang. Walla walla ding ding dang dong. Yeah, the comic says Ardit Lily. L-I-L-I. Lily or Lili? Ardit Lili? Ardit Lala? Ardit Lili. I don't know. Who cares? Who gives a flying fuck? Let's try it again. Conan makes Lily 2. Barbarian Life, a Literary Biography of Conan the Barbarian, Volume Roy. Volume Roy?
I just don't think I can move through life knowing that a guy named Steven did this to me.
How could you let this happen, Steven?
Your podcast sucks.
Enough talk.
Great Krom.